For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation. Wrestling with history worldwide in the VOC Nation Wrestling Network, the voice of choice, Bruce Swart, Killer Ken Resnick, and the man that Hulk Hogan is deathly afraid of, Wonderful Willie, the legend maker, that strikes fear in Pat McAfee as well, Mr. Bill Apter. What's happening, brother? Bill?
And Hogan does fear Apter, man.
We're going to go fast and furious today. We're recording on a time crunch. The world's back to normal. So my real job, I got to drive 2 hours into work every day. So who wants to do that on no sleep? Ken's got a hot date with his easy chair and the Milwaukee Bucks basketball game. And Bill Apter's got something upstairs that he's not telling us about.
I can't reveal it, but I do want to let you know that it is tied in with that sign.
Oh,
yeah, that's it.
Do you have anybody that's Jimmy Hearted into the deal?
Did that sign say what? Do not park here?
It does. That sign was held up probably about 15, 20 years ago by a fan at the Philadelphia Spectrum. And I hunted that fan down and I got that sign. And there's a picture of the fan holding the sign on the right-hand corner of it.
Isn't it a requirement that there's a Jimmy Hart sign anywhere that there's a Hulk Hogan sign?
No, there was no, Jimmy Hart was not involved at that point, but we love you, baby, we love you.
All right, last week we did a whole mailbag episode, and if you didn't get to hear it, go back and listen in the archive. Just search for the VOC Nation Wrestling Network on your favorite podcast app. You get all of our shows. Manny Fernandez just did a mailbag episode, and we did a whole show and nothing about his military career. So it was great. A lot of ravishing Rick Rude, talking about early days with Andre the Giant, Gerald Briscoe. You got to go back and listen to that. But we're here today. We're going to talk about the Hart Foundation. And last week, guys, before we got into the mailbag, we were going to talk about the Harts, and then we just never got to it. So we asked people to send us some questions, and we got some. Yay.
Well, this is amazing because I know some of the people that sent the questions. I stayed up for two nights writing some questions.
Yeah, well, so,
Bill Apter, 16 Wrestling Hall of Fames and 198 false IDs on the internet.
Absolutely. You're
Bill, you can follow Bill on Twitter at Apter1Wrestling. And I was watching some of the questions come through tagged to Bill on Twitter. And I'm just sitting there praying because we haven't really done this a whole lot. A lot of the questions we get come in through email or through the website. And I'm thinking, oh my God, Bill, please don't answer it. Don't answer it because you're going to give it away for the show. And thankfully, he didn't answer. You did very good, Bill.
Well, generally, I always answer my tweets, but yeah. I did get your text saying, Bill, don't answer. Yeah. I got it.
He did.
One of them, by the way, this guy that keeps, it's almost annoying at this point. All the tweets I'm getting from a guy named Seth Gibbs. Do you have any clue who that is?
You're going to get me fired. Let's move on.
Seth works for me
at another company, not VOC Nation. But anyway,
that. I wasn't going into that.
There he goes. He's going to get like
million Seth Gibbs.
600 friend requests on Facebook. And there I go. I'll be voted out by the board.
We talk about you every week, Seth.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Welcome. All right. All right, let's get on with this. Ken, I got a good one to start off with. It's from a guy named WrestleFan Dan on Twitter.
Was he talking about the great hunt for Andre the Giant's show on A&E, I hope?
No, but he was talking about Bill's legendary feud with Pat McAfee.
Oh, now it's legendary?
Legendary feud.
Oh, my God.
And WrestleFan Dan says, at VOC Nation, how dare anyone tell the legendary, wonderful Willie himself, Bill Apter, to F off. Disgraceful.
Yes, absolutely. It was. Yeah.
Any update? Are you in Hell in the Cell with Pat McAfee? Are we leading to a match? Are you working us, Bill?
I can't reveal all the details about this, but.
But Gene Okerlund will tell us on the hotline. No.
I wish he was still around to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, the Pat McAfee thing has died down a bit at this point. So I don't know if the Hell in a Cell match will actually take place unless there is another one or two releases from the WWE before Hell in a Cell. And we may be brought in as a substitute Hell in a Cell match.
Well, I heard the match was on, but they were just going to call it a little irritated in the phone booth match.
What? I like that.
Can you see them squeezing Bill and Pat in like one of those, the old school 1970s, 1980s phone booths, and, you know, they're clawing and scratching at each other. And then Bill tears off the receiver, bashes Pat over the head, but he can't get the cover because it's so small. His shoulders won't go down to the ground.
Oh, well, you remember The Undertaker and Mick Foley, when The Undertaker threw Mick Foley off the cage, this will be different. This will be an F off the cage.
Now, I've heard the match is set. The only holdup is Bill and Mr. McAfee are insisting it be included as one of the main events in the pay-per-view. And WWE is insisting it be on the pre-show.
Yeah, yeah. My agent, Mr. Kaufman, does not like that.
All right. At Different Styles on Twitter says, Bill Apter, did you ever go to the Hart House? And I'll ask the same question for Ken. Let's go to Bill first. Did you ever go inside of Stu's dungeon?
No, one of the few territories that I never got to was the area where Bret Hart was from, Calgary. Oh, that hurts. But no, I was never in the dungeon. I saw a lot of old 8mm movies and 16mm movies, but Mr. Weston, our publisher, had a very good photographer and reporter up there by the name of Bob Leonard. And Bob was in the Vancouver area and he covered that whole area for us. So no, I unfortunately never got to see that area.
Ken, were you ever in the Hart House?
No, I wasn't. I actually lived in Calgary for 6 months, but way before I ever got in wrestling. And, you know, Brett and I was involved with a hockey team up there, and Brett's a big, you know, hockey guy, owned the Calgary Hitmen for a while. So we kind of talked a lot about Calgary, but I was never in the Hart House. However, after watching the hunt for Andre the Giant treasures, I did spend an afternoon with Vince and Andre at his ranch in Ellerbe.
In Ellerbe, North Carolina. Wow.
Oh, Vince was there too. You told this story a couple weeks ago on the Andre episode. You didn't say Vince was there.
Yep, Vince was there, and that's when Andre had just come back, and we did the promos with Giant Machine.
Now, did you have to ride in the car with Vince at all?
No, in fact, it was funny. There was a little bit of miscommunication. George Scott, and this all went down like the day before. I was off for the weekend, and George Scott called me and said, hey, you got to go to Charlotte tomorrow. You've got to meet Vince, and you're going out to Andre's ranch. We're going to cut some promos. The production team will be there. You know, we'll have everything all set up, and you've got to meet, you know, Vince in Charlotte. And then I said, well, where, you know, and he says, I'll let you know. And he comes back and he says, meet him at the Hertz counter. And it was, you know, okay. So I get there, I go down to the Hertz counter and I'm waiting and waiting, and I've been waiting about 45 minutes. And, you know, the office is now closed. Well, what happened? George Scott told Vince I was going to meet him, but never told him what time or when I was getting in. My plane got in. So Vince and I forget who else, might have been Nelson Swagler, took off for Andre's ranch. And the only thing, and then I asked the guy, I gave him my ID at the Hertz counter, and he was nice enough to say, yeah, Vince McMahon rented a car, but he left about 45 minutes ago. So all I could do was I rented a car, got a map to Ellerbe. You know, thankfully it was a small town, pulled up into, you know, whatever restaurant was downtown, went in, the gal behind the counter, I showed her my WWF ID, said, you know, I'm supposed to meet Andre at the ranch. I don't know where the ranch is. You know, nobody gave me directions.
She's like, sure, pal.
And there was no TV.
Well, no, I had my WWF, you know, photo ID. So she was nice enough to give me the directions. And, you know, I followed them and got there. And you know, Vince was like, where were you? And I explained to him that it was just a you know, he didn't know he was supposed to wait for me. I didn't know that, you know, I thought I was supposed to wait for him when he wasn't there. But so we got there and, you know, spent the day with Andre and Frenchie and Joanne. So it was great to see those highlights of the ranch. And now I'm actually a little excited. Just heard from Martin D'Amato, you know, who's doing the gathering the end of July. Joanne is going to be there and bring some Andre things, memorabilia, and kind of do a little Q&A and answer fans' questions about what it was like to be with Andre.
Is it official? You're going to be at the gathering? Because there was a little uncertainty a couple of weeks ago.
No. About the Waterloo Hall of Fame, there was never any uncertainty about the gathering.
Okay, so you are going to the gathering. You will be there.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And what's the date?
I mean, that's always been the case. There was a little uncertainty about who was coming and if I was going to be at the George Tragos Luthez Hall of Fame this year, which turns out I'm not. Adnan is not coming in. It was kind of one of those that Stratus was going to be honored. She can't get in across the border. Don Kernodle was going to be honored. You know, he passed away. Adnan, you know, is not going to be there. So, you know, I was kind of really going to more to see them. I wasn't involved in anything other than going down to spend time with Sarge and Andre. And, you know, they kind of wanted me to like host a round table, which had I gone, I would have been glad to.
It would have been great.
Yeah, but the gathering, I've always been going to that. There's never been any question.
You know, you mentioned one thing when with the at the rental counter waiting for Vince, you mentioned a map. One of these weeks, I've got to tell you to and our listeners and viewers, the Vince McMahon get a map story. I never heard that, but it's not. When we do another show about Mr. McMahon, I will tell you that story.
See, he didn't even hang around long enough to order me to get a map. He just like, goodbye.
I got to get a map, the story. That's a good one.
I think you might have told that on the air, Bill. It was that infamous when Vince started changing his personality and Howard Finkel. We'll revisit that. Let's save that for another Vince episode. The gathering, by the way, number two is July 22nd to the 25th in the Hilton University Place, Charlotte, North Carolina. Go to tmartpromotions.com. A little cheap plug for you, Mr. Martin.
And I will not be there.
Bill will not be there, but Ken will. Ken, I wanted to know if you rode in the car with Vince and if the stories are true that he likes to pass gas and roll up the windows.
No, like I said, I had to get my own car and just kind of, you know, find my way to eventually. But it was funny, the promos and everything, we did so many of them that it was like a hour and a half to 2-hour drive from the Charlotte airport, and our planes were both leaving like in within 2 hours. Of course, there was no, you know, security to go through back then. It was pre 9/11. But I remember following Vince back to the airport, and we were doing like 95 miles an hour down these country roads to get to Charlotte. So, well, all I can attest to, when Vince was driving, he had no fear.
Not at all. And Bruce, you know, you twist things here. It's just, you know, once in a while, I wonder why you twist things. When you mentioned that he rolls down the windows and pass gas, it
rolls up.
Well, that's $3.50. I'm passing that one. We're going to find a cheaper gas station. That's $2.95. That's when they said he passed gas. That's what they were talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Abner, he'll be here all night.
Don't forget to tip your waiters and waitresses.
Rolling along on Twitter, Good and Plenty wants to know, oh, this is a generic question, was the Montreal screw job a work? How about you, Bill? Was the Montreal screw job a work? What is your opinion on that?
I have talked about this on many shows through the years. My opinion is that they were all in on this because Vince had to lose Brett. He couldn't afford him anymore. And Brett and Sean are two of my favorite human beings in the whole world. But I think that the two of them, Vince McMahon and several other people, came up with this scenario, and it was just going to help. It made Vince McMahon the biggest bad guy heel ever in the business, ever.
Kim, what do you think?
I agree with everything Bill said, but I don't think Brett was in on it. There were genuine hard feelings between Brett, Vince, Sean for a long, long time. And I know how proud Brett was of being a Canadian, being the champion. And I can absolutely see Brett saying, look, I'll do whatever you want, but I don't want to lose the title, you know, in Canada, you know, anything else. So, and I can see Brett, as old school as he was, as much respect as he had and has for the business, I can see Brett saying, look, I'm not, and there was not a lot of love lost between Sean and Brett going into this whole thing.
Correct.
So, I can see Brett saying, look, I'll do whatever you want, but I'm not dropping the belt to Sean in my home country.
Yeah, but if they came up with a scenario that wouldn't hurt Brett, because this accelerated his value, you know, once that night, I just think it was almost good for everybody the way that thing happened.
Yeah, I think certainly more than Vince what was in on it, but I don't think Brett was.
To me, nothing in the wrestling business like that. And it's rare I ever talk about these kind of things. It's not my shtick. But I don't think anything that happens sensational as that in the wrestling business is not worked out ahead of time.
Earl Hebner. And we got a couple of questions about whether or not you guys had talked to Earl. But I'll say this. If you go back to In the Room, I think it was maybe late 2019. It was before the pandemic. We had Earl on with Brady Hicks and the Maestro. And Earl said on the air here on VOC Nation that the Montreal screw job was a work. And he said that he wasn't briefed on it, but he believed that everybody else was. And it was his opinion that it was a work. And
he got caught in the middle of it.
Yeah. And he said that he was upset about it because it affected his relationships in the business for people that did, and he couldn't, you know, they assumed that he was in on it too. And you have to go back and listen to that. But
yeah, and that's one of the things why, you know, I kind of feel like I do. I mean, Earl talked about how much it affected his relationship with Brett. And if it was a work to the point where Brett was in on it and agreed with it, why would that have affected that relationship down the road?
But look what we're doing here. We're discussing this how many years after this happened?
Yeah. So again, 97.
This is what they all wanted to happen. This has been a great show. We're talking about Gas and Earl.
And that also, you know, Ken, and I guess I have to go back and listen to it again, because I remember Earl saying that. And then also Earl saying how it affected his relationship with Brett. So those two things don't line up. So maybe Earl was saying that it was a work and everybody was in on it, but Brett.
See, that's my feeling. That you know, I subscribe to that. Absolutely. I think everybody else was. I don't think Brett was.
Bill, did you talk to anybody else in the, no pun intended, in the room where it happened? Anybody like, Pritchard's on record with his stuff. Russo's come out with his stuff. Have you talked to anybody that has some hot takes on that incident?
Me?
Bill, being on.
I have not, except one or two people after it happened, that when we talked about Vince getting the black eye, and he says that was all part of what was going on. Vince just hit me. That's it. You know, this is, yeah.
All right. Let's take a quick break and we will come back on the other side with some more questions, more on the hearts. We'll dive a little bit deeper right here on Wrestling with History. This is the Heart Foundation episode, Killer Ken, Bill After, and the VOC. Wrestling with History on the VOC Nation Wrestling Network. VOC Nation takes wrestling fans behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Get stories and inside information from people who worked on the other side of the curtain. Follow the VOC Nation Wrestling Network podcast feed and get weekly shows from hosts like Bill After, The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, Ken Resnick, The Maestro, Shelly Martinez, Wes Briscoe, and more. Visit VOCNation.com for more information and follow us on Twitter at VOCNation. You all never know it, but at the rate we're going, we'll never finish the show. Wrestling with History back here on the VOC Nation Wrestling Network.
Hold on a minute. I'm getting a call.
No more calls, Bill. No more calls. We're an hour into it, or 20 minutes into an hour show, or an hour into it, whatever.
Right, this is Mr. Gibbs. Yes, we did mention you. Thank you, sir. Okay.
You know, I feel like I listen to so many podcasts now. I think I'm the only, because radio is ingrained in my spirit, I'm the only person that like throws in and out of breaks. Most of the shows just like insert a random break into like the middle of a sentence. That's ridiculous. But anyway, I digress. Okay.
Radio was so ingrained with you, but as you move forward in your life experience, you're going to find out there's something called television, which is just going to blow you away.
Amazing.
And then the internet. My wife keeps telling me to check that out.
It's pretty cool.
Remember, that was Al Gore invented that.
That was Rhino. He did the gore.
I thought Trump invented the internet. We finished good and plenty. Let's go to Ema. Sam in Arkansas. Was Jim Neidhart always into overindulging? Did either one of you? Jim was a little beat up in the press in his later years for overindulging in the drugs and alcohol. I spent a lot of time with Jim Neidhart. Recently, in the last 10 years, traveled a lot with them. We did a lot of events and signings together. I'm by no means an agent or a wrestling booker, but we would do shows like this live. And every once in a while, we'd bring somebody with us to sign autographs. And I got to know Jim. And, I've known Jim to have a drink or two, but I've never seen what I've heard other people talk about. Either of you have any of those stories?
No, not at all.
You know, I work with Jim. We did a ton of interviews when he was with Brett and Jimmy Hart as the Hart Foundation. Never once did he look like, you know, he was, you know, overindulged in anything and couldn't do great interviews. So in all that time, I think that was one of those that, you know, maybe at night in the bar, somebody saw him having a few, but never, ever. Did he come to an arena like that? And, you know, I was going to say, and I know we were going to talk about the Hart Foundation. I was thinking about it. Remember, guys, when we did the show about Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
And I said, Piper had this ability that when you watched his interviews as a fan, you weren't really sure if he was a little bit nuts,
yeah,
and was really going to do what he said he was going to do to his opponent. And I was thinking in all the years, convention, things I've gone, the three guys that I get asked most about what they were really like, were they really insane? Were they really out to hurt people? Was Rowdy Roddy Piper, Mad Dog Vachon, and Jim the Anvil Neihardt. If you look at a lot of his interviews, Jim could have kind of come up with this freakish grin, and his intensity would build, like I talked about Roddy Piper did, that those were the three wrestlers that I get asked most about that fans just weren't sure what they might see when they got into the ring. Yeah. And I think that's a huge testament to the talent that all three of those men had.
Yeah, see, I in terms of Jim Neidhart, I knew him, but not him using any drugs or that part of it. I never really got into that with any of the people in the wrestling business. It was just something that I just, I don't know, not interested in. They did it, I walked away, and I didn't really know about it. But there's one guy in the Hart Foundation that none of us have talked about at all.
Dangerous Danny Davis.
Absolutely. How did you read my mind just now?
Because I got a question on him, and I actually didn't include it in the show. And Ken and I did a show. We interviewed Danny for like an hour and a half.
Great guy. I talked to him periodically on Facebook. Great guy.
Yeah. Bill, while we're on that, let's talk about Danny Davis. Now, Danny said, and I invite everybody, this is way, way back in the archives. You go back to Wrestling with History. And you know what? I'll dig it up and I'll put it up at the top of the feed. And you can listen to the show with Danny Davis. And I figured he probably covered a lot of what we could talk about. But Bill, were you surprised when they went with Danny Davis for the big angle heading into WrestleMania 3, knowing that Danny was really just a referee and a ring?
No,
he was a ring attendant too, setup guy.
I was not surprised because he was one of Vince's earliest confidants. So I knew that that Vince eventually was going to do something special with him, and he was the right guy at the right time. He had that he was really the first bad guy referee that we had seen at all. And I'm talking about even back in when I started watching wrestling in the late 50s as a kid, I never saw a bad guy referee. So this was like, and he played it so absolutely perfectly. Yeah, no, he was the right guy for the job.
Yeah, Ken, you were there, right?
I wasn't surprised at all. You know, this was pre-internet, and all you really had, you know, the magazines, by the time you'd write the story and by the time they get printed and get set out, they were about a month behind, you know, by the time they got to the newsstand.
Yeah, longer, actually.
Yeah, even longer. And the only thing was really the dirt sheets that would get mailed out weekly because, you know, they like mimeograph them and send them out. And Vince was, you know, back then it was still the kayfabe days. Vince was really concerned about nothing leaking, you know, the element of surprise and shocking fans. And Danny was a guy that, as Bill said, was kind of a confidant. And he was one of the people that I think Vince was comfortable that A, could pull it off, but B, and I think more importantly, he could trust not to leak it.
Absolutely. And
so based on those two, no, I wasn't, you know, surprised.
Yeah, he was back in the days with Howard Finkel and that whole group of people that surrounded Vince and were very loyal to him, and they believed in keeping the kayfabe.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Dave Hebner was over telling Dave Meltzer secrets for $100.
But, you know, not all.
And the other thing, you know.
Go ahead, Bill, and then Ken.
So back then, you know, there were people that subscribed to the sheets back then, but more so, other than maybe if Dave Meltzer's thing was around back then, most of the sheets were like giving information about wrestling and not the, the real stuff that was going on. They weren't all dirt sheets. There were fan bulletins, like Georgie Ann Macropoulos and people like that, that were doing stuff like that.
Ken, what were you going to say?
And one of the other things, you know, Bill just alluded to it for a second, but I think also played into it, you know, even back then, not only was he a trusted confidant, but like Bill said, I mean, Danny would set up the ring. Danny would, you know, work, get the concessions in. I mean, Danny was someone they could send on the road, and they knew he would, you know, willingly contribute more than just, you know, as a referee. So it really was kind of a win-win, you know what I mean? Danny was there. He would help with whatever he saw needed some help. So I think I'm guessing that probably all factored into it.
Yeah. When you talk about the Hart Foundation, you've got to include him. And of course, you know, we talk about Bret Hart and Jimmy Hart, of course, as well.
Right. Well, and I want, that leads me to another question real quick before we get there from Ron in Tulsa. Danny Davis told us that he would go and set up the ring. Yep. He'd work the first match on the card as like the spoiler under a mask.
Mr. X. Yes.
Dr. X. And then he'd come back out and referee a couple of matches. Mm-hmm. And so he was a jack of all trades. What a tremendous talent. Before we leave, the guys that would leak to the dirt sheets, right? And Ken, was that something that was talked about? And Terry Taylor is always picked on as, you know, a guy that would, you know, squeal to Meltzer and tell him what was happening. Was that an active like topic in the office? Was there like, hey, you better not talk to these guys, Meltzer?
You know, I don't know if it was big, you know, I mean, like with me, a lot of times, you know, we would do interviews sometimes just based on availability for a market. We might tape an interview about what happened in a match that wasn't even going to occur for like 2 weeks. So they would have that interview to put into the, you know, next week's show. And, you know, I remember just being kind of told like, and you understand anything you do, you don't talk about out of school. And, you know, I was in the kayfabe era, even from the AWA. So I think they realized they didn't have to worry about me being, you know, telling tales out of school or, you know, tipping off someone. So if it was big in the office, they were never worried about me doing it. So, you know, I really didn't hear much about it.
Yeah.
Bill, you guys used to print results from the shows, you know, well after they happened, but I always wondered, the fans that are sitting there watching like a 4 week TV taping. I mean, first of all, it must be a dreadful thing to sit there through 6 hours of TV tapings and the same people coming out over and over again. But doesn't that break the magic a little bit for the people in those buildings? If you're there and you see something and you see like multiple angles on the same show, and you know, it's then it being played out on TV as if it's happening organically week after week, doesn't the fan that attends that show, isn't it all lost?
How many fans are at that show when you look at the amount of fans worldwide that are seeing it on TV and not realizing that these things were, the basic fan didn't know that these shows a lot of times were taped 3 and 4 weeks in advance.
Well, like when I was there, we did Poughkeepsie, you know, every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But if you think back on it, Bruce and Bill, as you well know, back then there was no internet, you know, it didn't get out and was just the fans in Poughkeepsie. But remember, this was just the earliest stage of pay-per-views. So even to a large degree, what happened on TV tapings was mostly to set up the house shows.
Right.
So not a lot of big things played out on television at the tapings before they happened at a major house show.
Right.
And a lot of times, if you look back at superstars, sometimes, you know, we would suddenly talk about what happened last week at Madison Square Garden or Boston Garden or Toronto and the ramifications. So not a lot of major angles broke, you know, on TV, or if they did, you know, the turnaround from TV to the first week was only a few days. So right. If anything like that happened, it generally was at the first week's taping.
Yeah, and then
so
they did
would air really quick.
If you really think about it, the Vince and the promoting people didn't really care. You have an audience that's there for 4 or 5 hours, and as long as they're staying there, they you know, how are these people going to tell what's going on? Like Ken said, there's no internet back in those days. And in the magazines, we were careful about, you know, we didn't print 4 shows worth, even though it was came out 3 months later. You know, we would take maybe one of those 3 or 4 hours and print the results.
Yeah. And again, like if something was going to happen on TV, it almost happened in, you know, we would tape 3 hours. It would almost always go down in the first week taping, which, you know, it might be a Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, but they would, the turnaround and the editing, you know, the interviews would have been done. There was a, you know, minute 54 seconds. So a lot of times we might tape on a Wednesday, Thursday, and that show would air on Superstars in New York on Saturday. So there wasn't a lot of time where they were really needed to keep it secret.
And it wasn't sequential,
you know,
right?
Do you know how they kept the audience there?
How?
By the way, by saying that at the end of the taping, the last night of the match will be Sergeant Slaughter against Hulk Hogan.
Oh, it was always
They always had a dark match to hold the fans that they would stay for those shows.
Yeah. And it wasn't sequential, right? I mean, they're post-producing that and splitting it up into different.
At least in the days of Poughkeepsie, and then we would tape in Brantford, Ontario for Canadian content, they pretty much did it, you know, okay, week one, it's going to be this, 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 and this, you know, then week two, this, this, and this, and then, you know, week three. For the most part, the matches happened sequentially. And it was one of those things, remember, that was very much the kayfabe era. So the thought was, even though it was just a couple thousand people in Poughkeepsie, they didn't really want to smarten them up. They wanted it to happen as it happened.
Right.
And I mean, they were also very conscious that, you know, if somebody seemingly got hurt in the first week's taping, they might come back in the third week. But so in reality, in the fans' mind, okay, they've had, you know, an hour and a half to kind of recover. So they were very much aware of you know, everything. And to that point, far more so in WWF than AWA. They were very conscious of all of that.
Very good. Well, there you go. For all of you that were wondering how that went down, to me, it's still like I'm picturing somebody sitting there watching it, you know, thinking that the guy rested for 2 hours, came back out, but then he watches it on TV. And the second week, you know, he sees like Ricky Steamboat in a neck brace, you know, acting like he can't talk. Meanwhile, they know that he came back out on the same show. But like you guys said, it's they're probably scratching their head and then thinking, oh, well, I like this stuff.
And remember too, Bruce, back then, we didn't really do any, you know, very few live ringside or in ring interviews. So if someone was, you know, got hurt and couldn't talk in week one, they didn't come back to wrestle that night, but we could tape interviews behind the scenes with them.
Absolutely.
For like, you know, the second week where they could barely talk, but they were really keenly aware of not doing anything that would, you know,
insult intelligence,
to smarten anybody up.
Again, there was no internet. The internet changed the whole business.
You know what I mean? We would have, you know, pre-production meetings, you know, with everyone where they would review if they were going to do something, well, so-and-so couldn't come back out, and then we need to do interviews for all the markets and for superstars. And you know what? We need to maybe do a generic one about how his injury is. I mean, it was, you know, really well thought out. It wasn't willy-nilly.
Yeah, very, it's interesting to me. I mean, very interesting. And you said AWA was even more protective or less, or they weren't?
I'm saying, you know, like we never had pre-production meetings in the AWA. But, you know, from day one, the first time I worked at WWF taping, you know, involving interviews, everything else, they were on top of it. Well, okay, we did this. All right, now this is the first time in this market we're going to see so-and-so after being hurt. Okay, no, he hasn't been hurt in that market. I mean, they, and a lot of that was to, you know, Howard Finkel was kind of the historian, yes, in terms of what had aired, what took place in what market. Always, you know, if we'd been running a program or around the territory, you know, sometimes they would switch it up. They might put somebody else over. They might do a different finish, just, you know, switch it up. And if the guys weren't sure, they would always, you know, and sometime we'd have to take a quick break. Howard would go through his notes and say, okay, last time in Salt Lake, you know, Ricky, you won because of this, but now wait a minute, in Denver, Macho Man, you won. So, I mean, they were really, really, you know, on top of it, you know, far more so than the, you know, AWA.
VOC Nation takes wrestling fans behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Get stories and inside information from people who worked on the other side of the curtain. Follow the VOC Nation Wrestling Network podcast feed and get weekly shows from hosts like Bill Apter, The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, Ken Resnick, The Maestro, Shelly Martinez, Wes Briscoe, and more. Visit VOCNation.com for more information and follow us on Twitter at VOCNation. I feel like I could cut out that entire segment and make it its own show. That's how educational it was and off topic and completely my fault. Ron in Tulsa wanted to know, was Jimmy Hart only paired with the Hart Foundation due to his name being the same? That's interesting. And by the way, I've seen his license. His name is Jimmy Ray Hart. That's his name, not a gimmick name.
He was just, I think maybe at the beginning that was true, but he turned out to be, I mean, the chemistry with he and Neidhart and Brett and Danny Davis was just so perfectly natural.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy was one of those, he could fit in and develop chemistry with, you know, anybody. And I'm guessing somebody probably said, well, hey, this guy's Jimmy Hart. Well, let's put him with the Hart Foundation.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and that probably what triggered it. And then all of a sudden they realized, hey, Jimmy Hart is quite a talent. We got to start, you know, branching him out. He can really help us.
You ever go to lunch with Jimmy?
Did I?
Yeah.
Beans and potatoes. Loves his soup and salad with extra pepper.
I thought I schmoozed with servers. He's one of the few people who can schmooze as well, if not better, than I can with a server.
I've used Jimmy Hart a lot in corporate events, and I've taken him out to Vegas a bunch of times, and he literally, we have to eat at the same restaurant, Diablo's in, I forget the hotel, maybe it's Mandalay Bay, but every single meal, every single day has to be at Diablo's. So shout out to the staff at Diablo's. And I think they have some signed shirts by Mr. Hart, who very much enjoys the food and the atmosphere. Okay, wrapping it up here, a couple more. I got two more about Brett and Neidhart. So let's go with Sunshine Babisha on Twitter. Did any promoters or bookers think that Jim Neidhart was the bigger star of the two? And I'm guessing early on, was Jim Neidhart viewed as the breakout star versus Bret Hart, who ultimately
I don't know the answer to that, yeah. But I think, you know, he was a little more established at the beginning there. And people did think that, you know, he was going to be the big star of the group. But it turned out to be, you know, Brett took the spotlight.
Let me weave this in, and I'll give Dan from Pennsylvania credit for this, or I'll just mention him because he asked if Ken and Bill saw Brett as the top star early on. But I guess my question is, back in the early days of the Hart Foundation, and I'll ask this to Ken because he was literally there from almost when they started, did Vince or Pat or any of the backstage booking type people see them as, okay, eventually these guys are going to break out and become singles? Or was it, these guys are the Killer Bees, you know, or the Rougeos, they're going to be tag team forever?
You know, I think it started out, you know, they were a great tag team. And, you know, remember from Vince, from Pat, from Arnie Skolan, the fact they, you know, both were trained at the Hart House. They knew their fundamentals, you know, were second to none. They didn't have to worry about that. I kind of got the impression a little bit that they recognized Brett was probably the better of the two as a singles match, pacing it in a singles, where Jim was just a great tag team partner. I mean, Jim's feeling for tags and the timing of a tag team was just phenomenal. And I mean, Brett was great too, but I think the thinking may have began to evolve that Brett might be a little bit better of a singles wrestler than Jim. And Jim is certainly an outstanding tag team wrestler. I mean, he really understood, you know, the psychology of tag team wrestling. So I'm guessing that might have factored in a little bit.
I think one of the other factors, and this is just things that I heard back in the early days, that Brett was a lot more easy to control than Jim was. That Jim was more fun-loving and hot-headed than Brett. Brett was still kind of, you know, Stu Hart's son, and had this whole reputation to uphold about the Hart family.
I would agree with that completely, Bill, but not to mislead, I don't think anybody thought Jim was a hothead to the point of maybe not being able to control.
No.
But Jim was certainly the more fun loving. I mean, Brett was
absolutely
quiet, studious. You know, Jim was more outgoing, fun loving, but not, you know, hard to control or anything along those lines.
Yeah, no, I'm just telling you what I had heard on the road with a lot of the other guys.
Bill, were you surprised? And I guess tying a bow on this, were you surprised that Brett wasn't a bigger success in WCW? I mean, the fans kind of rejected him from the beginning, didn't really buy into him. Maybe the promotion was on its way down, but were you surprised that Brett wasn't a bigger star there?
I think the fans got the feeling that they didn't know what they were going to do with Bret Hart. And they brought him in, you know, as Bret Hart, but, you know, he's just came from that whole Montreal screw job thing, et cetera, and all that. There was a lot of controversy going on. But I just think they were waiting to see what was going to happen to him. And I don't think the promotion did it fast, put him on that pedestal fast enough.
Yeah, I think the Bill's right, and the fans were kind of waiting, but I think the promotion was kind of waiting to figure it out.
Yeah,
I mean, they brought him out, and it was like they brought him out to this fanfare, but with no real purpose.
And what do we do?
You know, it's like, and yeah, ladies and gentlemen, but, you know, okay, next match.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think maybe in a rush to put it to Vince. They brought him out before they really knew what they were going to do with him. And I mean, you know, I remember watching and, oh my God, Bret Hart is there. And okay, Bret Hart is there. Well, okay, Bret Hart is there. What are you going to, oh, okay, Bret Hart. It's like this, you know, big build-up. Oh my God, look who's here. And we'll be back after this.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen, I would have loved to have seen, and again, this is just the fan in me, that first week. Well, Brett, if you think you got screwed where you were before, wait till you see what the end of, wait till you see what we're going to do to you.
Yeah, yeah. Instead they like,
oh my God, what are they going to do to him?
Yeah.
Right? Make him a victim.
They like teased him joining or, you know.
Yeah, but make him a victim.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I think people, they hated Vince because of what he did, but they hated Brett because of how he was acting. You know, they, you know, I'm annoyed at this guy. So they could have made him a heel. I think they just, it was too wishy-washy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I've been asked, and to me, that was one of the bigger failings of, you know, WCW. I mean, for a while, you know, along with Hulk, Brett was kind of the face of WWF, great champion, great, you know, pedigree, you know, just, and they just, they brought him out and just kind of, he hung around. That they never really had a program set as to what they were going to do. And that was one of the things, and Bill knows this better than anyone, about Vince. Vince knew 6 months before WrestleMania what the main event was going to be and how he was going to put it in the works to come to the crescendo at WrestleMania.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I don't think WCW was operating with that much foresight. And it's like anything, you know, you all know, when suddenly a wrestler doesn't mean much, it's really hard to get him to mean something again.
Yeah. It's hard to, it's hard to put the, what, once you open Pandora's box, it's hard to put the lid back on. All right. That does it for this week. The Hart Foundation, along with a really good segment about TV tapings, multi-week TV tapings.
Yeah, so, I love that. Was, even though I was around in those days, I learned.
That's a great 10 minutes. If I was doing radio, I'd say you'd have to go back and listen to that. But obviously, if you're this far, you got through that as well. Well, at least we hope so, because you got to listen to like 20% for us to get paid. All right. We're working on a guest. So we don't normally do guests on this show, but we're working on a guest in the next couple of weeks. Mike McGurk, who was a lot of you might know her as the ring announcer from Wrestling Challenge for a couple of years in the 80s, but she was Leroy McGurk's daughter, and she's got a lot of experience in the wrestling business.
Look up Leroy McGurk, by the way, on Wikipedia.
The blind commentator. Go figure.
There was a lot more. He was a wrestler. I mean, he was so much more.
You know, and I've been very, very lucky to get a chance to work with a lot of great people in wrestling and establish some friendships. I mean, God, Bill and I go back to my AWA days, but you know, I'm on record. Mike McGurk is one of my favorite people. She's just an awesome, awesome lady.
She would send you guys the link to log into this show every week on time. No doubt about it. And wouldn't make fun of you saying that Manny Fernandez can get it right and you can't. She definitely would do that.
Seth, he's doing it again. Yeah.
All right. That's it. That's it for this week. For the legendary duo of Killer Ken Resnick and Wonderful Willie, the legend maker, Bill Apter, who Hulk Hogan fears, by the way.
Pat McAfee does not,
for sure. I'm the voice of choice, Bruce Wirt. Bill?
We'll see you pretty soon at the matches.
Yeah.
It's getting closer.
Have a good week, everybody. We'll see you next one.